So it's 3 o'clock and we'll start our Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee. And it's new, so it's our first time this committee's been here. And I will tell you that I have this cold that has transferred itself into my throat. So it's difficult sometimes if I go up and down, that's what's happening. But to begin, we'd really like to have an opportunity for each of us to get to know each other, so and the people out there that are watching. So I will start with Senator Pruszynski, a little bit about you and where you're from, and whatever else you want to share.
I heard that speech.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. I'm Floyd Pruszynski, State Senator for District 4. District 4 includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. This is starting my 10th year in the Senate and had the opportunity to serve in the House prior to that, I believe, about 7 years. Welcome this opportunity to be on this committee. I think it's a very important task that we have in working and making certain that our rural communities are, in fact, having an opportunity to see economic development where they have not been able to do so in the past near future. And hopefully we will be able to accommodate a lot of the concerns I've heard from constituents as to the need for us to try to help facilitate better private-public cooperation and partnerships so we can have communities throughout the state flourishing and not necessarily seeing all the economic hubs in the greater metro areas being more the perceived, at least, individual communities that seem to be getting the lion's share, even though we know that we need these economic engines. We do have a lot of parts that make up the whole vehicle. Thank you.
So Herman Bertschiger, Senate District 2, which is Josephine and northern part of Jackson County, both pretty rural areas of the state of Oregon and highly dependent on natural resources. I hope I can bring some clarity to some of the understanding of what takes place as we deal with these natural resources and why it's such a vital part of rural Oregon. I think the formation of this committee was a positive step in the right direction, and looking forward to working with the members here. And we've got quite a few issues ahead of us over the next few months, and I'm looking forward to it. Thanks.
And we'll go to the other end. Senator?
Well, I'm Senator Jenny Burdick, and I am the token urbanite on this committee. but I've been in the Senate now for 16 years, but I started my public policy career on the Land Conservation and Development Commission, where I worked primarily with rural issues surrounding the land use program. And so I feel like in some ways I'm coming home to some of these issues. I represent parts of Southwest Portland and Tigard, but I see myself as an Oregonian first, and you know, of course, I'm very loyal to my district, but I do see us as a as an entire state, that all if all parts of the state aren't healthy, then none of the state is healthy, and that's the mentality I bring to this committee. And you'll occasionally hear about Portland from me.
Hi, I'm Betsy Close, and I am new to the Senate this legislative session. I served 6 years in the Oregon House, chaired Water and Environment there, chaired Business, Labor and Consumer Affairs, and co-chaired Natural Resources with Senator Ferraioli. So I hope to bring some past work and good skills to the committee. I represent Senate District 8, which is Lynn and Benton counties, a very powerful agricultural area, and we are formerly the grass seed capital of the world, still have a lot of grass seed, and also the home of Oregon State University, the very brave and great beavers.
Thank you very much. And I'm Arne Roblin, Senate District 5. It's about two-thirds of the Oregon coast, and then a little bit of the valley. So I go from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay, and then out to into Sheridan and Falls City in the valley. So a fairly large geographic area that represents a lot of people who have similar interests. And I'm really excited about this committee because it really can highlight the things that are important to my area and the rural parts of Oregon. It is exciting to have this avenue to start having conversations about things that can help the economic development of rural areas. And today we're going to have a number of those. And I just want to thank, I am really impressed with who we have on our committee. It's a great group of people. And I actually know, because of conversations firsthand, that our urban legislator started her career as a reporter in my old hometown of Port Angeles, Washington. And so that was a nice rural part of Washington. So I know that she's had to cover issues that go to rural areas for a long time. So we are pleased with that as well. And I'd like to introduce actually our the brains of the outfit, our administrator, Raquel Rainsier. I hope I got that right. Has been in the Capitol a couple different sessions, 2011, and now coming back and helping us as the administrator for our committee. And I'll let her introduce her staff.
So we have Shelley Raska here, and she is our committee assistant and doing a wonderful job for us today. Thank you, Shelley.
So with that, we'll do our first order of business so that we don't get ourselves in trouble, and that is to I'll accept a motion on accepting the rules of our committee.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the proposed committee rules.
And Senator Burtschager moves to adopt proposed committee rules dated February 5th, 2013. Is there any objection? Any discussion? I should do that first. I'm seeing none of either. They are passed, and we will now move to our first. And before that, we get going, I'm going to pass this around. You can take time doing it. I thought it would be good for each of us to have whatever information the other wants to share on the committee with respect to cell phones and other stuff. It won't be public. It'll just be for our committees, if you want. Most of it's already public. Mine's already public. All of it is. But if people want to share that so we can get a hold of you, if there's any times that we need to get a hold of you. So with that, we'll have an informational meeting on what it is when we talk about Oregon's right to farm law. And a lot of people ask that who are non-rural, and I just thought it would be a good informational meeting to get started by letting people understand some of the things that are in place so that as we go through different issues in rural areas, we'll have a better understanding of how to move forward. So with that, I'm going to invite Lauren Henderson, Jim Johnson, and Katie Fast up to be our first panel. And however you want to start that, I will let you guys begin. I thank you all for being here.
Good afternoon. For the record, Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And before I get started, Director Koba sends her regards to all of you and certainly wishes she could be here. She's currently in Washington, D.C., I think, with meetings with congressional staff today as part of the National Association of State Directors of Ag, which is a very important meeting for us. We're here today to provide an overview of right to farm. I have with me Jim Johnson, who is our land use specialist. And if it's okay, Chair Roblin, I'll just let him get started, and we'll be available to answer questions anytime.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Johnson. Right to farm is not always a real understood part of Oregon state law, so I'm going to try to get through this without being too technical, but sometimes it kind of gets there, and Senator Przanski would know this better than anybody. It can get really legal, so to speak, or whatever. But I right up front, I want to mention that Oregon's right to farm law is actually Oregon's right to farm and forest. But since this is the Department of Agriculture, I'm just going to focus on the farm part of it. And most of what I have to say could go over to the forest side with a few little changes in technicalities. So with that, there's really two major components to Oregon's right to farm law. The first deals with providing immunity from private actions, so private court actions or the like, against agricultural practices, farming practices. The second is a prohibition against regulation of farming practices by local governments. And I'll develop both of these more as we get into the presentation. It's really important to understand that Oregon's right to farm law has several components that if you don't comply with all those components, then you don't qualify for the protection. And it really relates to things that are generated by the farming operation, not by the surrounding land uses. Compatibility issues like trespass and vandalism and things like that are more land use issues, and that's a presentation for another day. What we're really talking about are the impacts to farming and forest practices related to nuisance or trespass and issues, and I'll talk about what that means in a second. But the components to qualifying for immunity from right to farm involve farming and forest practices, lands zoned for farm or forest use, dealing with nuisance or trespass issues. A real key component in defining what a farming practice is, in other words, what is protected under right to farm, is first, what is a farm? When you look at the definition of a farm in the statute, this is really important because it comes up an awful lot, is that it's the obvious things, you know, the things that happen on a farm, but the key element in this definition a lot of times is that term that I have underlined there, used in the commercial production of, and then crops, nursery stock, and so on. That's really key because right to farm does not protect hobby farms. So if somebody's out there and they're raising a few horses for their own use, they're not selling those horses or whatever, and there's a complaint about, you know, whatever it is, odor or flies, whatever, they're not protected by right to farm because it's not the commercial production of that thing. So hobby farming practices and like are not protected by right to farm, and that's very, very important. A lot of the calls we get about this, about right to farm and the like, really end up, you know, it's not a commercial production facility or anything like that, so right to farm doesn't apply. Okay, is this going to move? There we go. Okay. Definition of a farming practice, mode of operation that includes this list of elements here. And without going through a lot of these, it's important when you read these that there's an awful lot of interpretation or discretion here. Mode of operation used on a farm of a similar nature. There's not a definition for that. Is generally accepted, reasonable and prudent method for operation. Again, some interpretation there. Is or may become a generally accepted, reasonable and prudent method. This next one is very important. Complies with applicable laws. If, for example, you have a complaint related to pesticides application and a nuisance complaint, and it's dealing with drift. Drift is not legal in Oregon under pesticides law, so a complaint dealing with drift would not be protected by right to farm because it wouldn't be consistent with the applicable laws. If you had a confined animal feeding operation, they had a permit from the Department of Agriculture, and there were conditions in that permit, and there was any violations of those conditions, that operation wouldn't be protected by right to farm because it wouldn't be complying with applicable laws. And then the last is done in a reasonable and prudent method. These terms, when you start to get into a right to farm situation, end up in a court of law because these are decided currently in circuit court, ends up being a witness situation, what is considered to be a reasonable practice, what is an accepted practice and the like, and it can sometimes can get kind of, you know, battling of witnesses, so to speak. The other important element about this is a farming practice specifically includes the transportation of a movement of equipment in the statute. It specifically calls that out. So farmer driving his equipment on a road, as long as he's doing it in a reasonable and prudent manner and the like, is protected by right to farm also. Trespass. Again, I really want to point out when you look at these terms, these are really the nuisance or trespass related things. These aren't compatibility issues. So we're talking about things like noise, vibration, odor, smoke, use of pesticides, irrigation practices. These are the types of things that right to farm law is designed to protect. One of the things that I always point out here is this is why right to farm is really just one of the tools in the toolbox. A lot of those other issues, compatibility issues like trespass, vandalism, ability to farm next to non-compatible farm uses and like, those are land use issues. So land use law and right to farm law work together to ultimately provide that ability for a farmer to operate. Important issue here. Where does it apply? No farming or forest practice on lands zoned for farm or forest use. It doesn't say lands zoned for exclusive farm use. So there's been some discussion. Does this just apply in exclusive farm use zones, or does it apply in all zones that authorize farm use as a permitted use? One of the things we've looked at, if you look at this slide, at the section here that's lined out, actually was what the law said, I believe, in 95. It was either changed in 95 or 2001. The law used to say zone for farm or forest use occurring outside an urban growth boundary. That was stricken by the legislature. So we've basically said, because that's been stricken, the intent must have been to protect all farming and forest practices on lands that are zoned for farm or forest use. It could be a rural residential zone. Farming is permitted outright in a rural residential zone in whatever Questioning County you're talking about. Then arguably, the farming practice is protected in that zone because the property is zoned to allow farm use as a permitted use. So, bottom line, immunity is provided if it's consistent with those definitions we talked about. The lands are zoned for farm or forest use. Complies with the applicable laws, so no violation of some of the applicable laws, regardless of change of interruption of use. That's an important element. Other states, if you go, let's say you're operating a livestock operation and then you decide to put an orchard in, other states will say that's a change of use. You're no longer protected by right to farm. Oregon's law recognizes what the zoning is, and so if you're zoned for farm or forest use, you're protected for farm use, regardless if you change from one farm use to another, and that's a very important and key element. Except, though, in circumstances where you're not going to be protected if there's damage from the complaint to commercial agricultural products. So the nuisance or trespass actually is damage to commercial product or the like. Usually that doesn't happen without violating another law, like pesticides drift, for example. But it's there and it could happen. Or there was a death or serious injury involved. So you would go through your regular nuisance or trespass judicial process in both of those situations, as opposed to being provided the immunity by the right to farm law. Local ordinances. This is the second arm that I talked about. Local governments or special districts in Oregon are basically, in effect, precluded from regulating farming practice as a nuisance or a trespass. And this is retroactive. So if you have an existing law or you adopt a new law, local code cannot regulate farming practices for a nuisance or trespass. This only applies, though, to practices that actually would have qualified under the law. So if they, again, violated something or whatever, that could be regulated. This has been an issue off and on over the years where a local government has tried to, regulate farming practices around a city, for example, for odor or something like that, and the state statutes had to come into play to remind the local jurisdiction that they can't do that. It's really important to note that this is local government or special district. It doesn't preclude the state or federal government for regulating these types of practices. So bottom line, some of the issues that we hear about relating to right to farm is ultimately right to farm still doesn't prevent a suit from being filed against a farmer or a rancher. They're still going to have to defend themselves in court and prove up that they qualify, that the immunity's there, but the lawsuit's there. So the farmer or rancher, because he's going to have to defend, is going to have that cost to still deal with. Right to farm does talk about legal costs. The prevailing party shall be entitled to judgment for reasonable attorney fees and costs. That hasn't always worked out the way some people feel it should be, and you may hear from Katie Fast an issue related to right to farm dealing with attorney's fees and the costs. That's always an issue with the agriculture community. We're provided this immunity, yet we've got to defend ourselves and incur these costs. Interpretation. When I talk to people around the country that do deal with right to farm laws in other states and the like, there's lots of different ways to involve it, but everybody has this question about definitions. Remember some of those terms, reasonable and commonly accepted and things like that. So there's a lot of interpretation involved, and that is an issue. Do you do better definition? Do you leave it to have the flexibility and do it on a case by case? That's something that's discussed quite a bit in the policy world or around right to farm. The decisions in Right to Farm are made by the circuit court. Usually judges and circuit courts don't have a lot of expertise in agricultural practices. There's been some very consistent decisions. There's been some kind of strange decisions in Right to Farms coming out of circuit courts. So that's an issue. Should there be a tribunal in land use we have LUBA, should there be something, somebody else that looks at these types of things? That's the question that comes up once in a while. The legality issue. In other states, Right to Farm has been determined to be unconstitutional. So that is an issue that's always in the background. I'm not a lawyer, but one of the things that I've always said when I look at other states' right-to-farm laws versus Oregon's is tied to the land use designation of property, so it's not an ad hoc or wide-open thing. It actually is tied to a state's plan on what the primary use should be for an area, so there's that connection, to the long-term land use. Right to Farm does not, and I'll end with this, protect farms from off-site conflicts, so trespass, dogs running wild, vandalism, trespass, those types of things. Doesn't protect from that, your ability to farm due to somebody locating your property land. Right to Farm doesn't do any of those types of protections. It does not preclude a jurisdiction from regulating a farm use from the perspective of land use regulation. So if there's a land use regulation that's regulating an agricultural practice related to protecting riparian habitat for a certain wildlife species or the like, that is not a right to farm issue. And right to farm really hasn't come to terms with recognizing that you've got certain areas where you've got two different primary uses, farm use in one situation, maybe a city in another, right there on that urban edge. And so how do you deal with some of those conflicts both ways where both major land uses both have primary land use rights? And I'll just end with that, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
So any questions right now? Yes.
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you. One of the issues that always came up in some of these right-to-farm issues were people moving into a farm area from the city, with dogs and so on, and then expecting to have their dogs protected if they, for example, killed sheep. And I saw your last slide where it didn't help you with conflicts. Is that a problem out there?
Senator Roblin, Senator Burdick, it still remains a problem. You can only regulate so much, but it's interesting when you talk to the agricultural community more and more in some of these edge areas where you've got rural residential, non-farm development, and agriculture things mixing and the like. Things like dogs chasing livestock and the like, there are regulations that deal with that, but it's not always that clear cut, and those are not right to farm issues. Those are more compatibility issues or other legal issues. So that's always a tough one. When I worked for Wasco County, we had some real infamous cases with dogs and livestock and where that went to court and the such. So,
other questions?
No.
Questions? Okay. Katie.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I think Mr. Johnson did a well job of describing the nuances in the law of right to farm and forest. But I'd like to give maybe more of the on-the-farm perspective and why, for the Farm Bureau, this is an important marriage with our land use laws. It really does stabilize expectations of the EFU and the practices that are going to take place in the EFU. And I think for a lot of us in the agricultural community, we look at land use planning as we've designated areas just like industrial zones and that there's appropriate activity in industrial zones. At the same time, the farm area is almost a prettier industrial zone because of the activities that we have taking place. And we've set aside those lands, and we need to protect the practices from nuisance complaints that we may express. And those are what I like to call the dirty side of farming. So the dirt and dust, the noise, the smells that are part of everyday activity and especially a part of the harvest times. The farm, right to farm and forest, is not it's more of a shield for the farming and forestry community. It's not a sword away from regulations. It gives us some protections from the nuisance claims. But as Jim lined out as kind of the pesticide example, it doesn't allow us to, cut our way out of environmental regulations or other farming regulations that impact practices or land use. Some of the issues that arise with it, maybe where it isn't, the perfect level of protection is that farmers and ranchers, if complaints come forward and a lawsuit comes forward, it doesn't prevent those. It does create an avenue where, they have to go to the expense to defend themselves. And as Jim said, many times in a court that doesn't understand agriculture. And so you are there explaining why this is a commonly accepted farming practice and why it fits on your operation and in that area. And there can be quite a bit of expense just to get those cases dismissed around right to farm and forest. But at the same time, I think it is probably one of our greatest ties and protections in the land use planning system and something that we are quite proud of in Oregon to have it withstand it for the number of years that it's been on the books and worked as well as it has. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Any questions?
Arnie?
Yes.
No.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, Katie, and also, Lauren, you mentioned that in some states it was ruled unconstitutional. I was just wondering what the justification was for that, what part of the Constitution they were talking about.
Senator Roblin, Senator Close, the most, to some of us, infamous case, I guess you would say, comes out of Iowa. And it relates to the determination there was that the use of right to farm in that state basically was a blanket easement over land without any input into that process. They don't tie it to a specific land use. They don't tie it to a zone or a district, for example. It was just basically this blanket right to farm across, protecting it in all circumstances. And the court found that that was a taking, in effect, a blanket easement over the land and ruled it unconstitutional on that purposes.
Thank you.
Can I do a follow-up on that?
Yeah. Oh. But Katie, want to answer?
Yeah, I would just, Chair Roblin, Senator Close, just to follow up, I think we've also had some legal analysis after that Iowa case of the Oregons and felt that that case was very different than what we have in Oregon and felt that ours met Oregon's constitutional requirements.
That's the point I want to make. I think that was on the state constitution, not on the federal constitution for Iowa. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So this is a question for either one of you. So one of the things I've noticed in our district over the last 20 years is the conflicts between farm equipment and vehicles on the highways. It seems to be developing into a more and more problem as the years go on, and there's less agriculture and there's more urban sprawl in our area. Are we seeing that across the state, or is this kind of isolated to my district?
Chair Roblin, Senator Bart Shugler. I have to practice a little bit. I think that is a growing issue as we see these urban-rural interfaces growing across Oregon, and we see more non-farm uses come into the EFU. The transportation issue is one, and one of concern that, one, we're moving our equipment in the safest manner as possible, but at the same time that people moving along the roads have an understanding of farm equipment and some education. And so at the Farm Bureau, we've tried to do some outreach during times of harvest, and other agricultural groups are doing the same. And that's the same time. This is the right to farm and forest covers transportation, but it's also a marriage with some of our other transportation laws that allow farmers to move equipment. And so it's that marriage of existing regulations with these nuisance protections.
Senator Roblin, Senator Barrett-Sugar, did I say, okay. I would agree with Katie, and I would add that we see this more and more not just as a right to farm issue, but as a compatibility issue on the side of land use. When we were dealing with the urban growth issues in the Portland metro region, one of the biggest complaints or issues I heard from all three of the counties, county farm bureaus in the area, whatever, was the ability to move equipment on the roads, forgetting whether it was a nuisance or trespass, just the time involved and the safety involved for the farmer to move that equipment. And more farmers plan around when to move their equipment based on when rush hour is or is not, and so it impacts their ability to farm depending on what type of product they're moving or whatever. Where we also see things like transportation-related events or whatever happening without consulting the agricultural community. I've seen roads closed during harvest season, and a seed grower or a grain grower or whatever can't get their product out of the field because of what's going on that road. So it's a land use issue also, and becoming much more and more so when we look at the implications of expansion of UGBs and the like.
So do you have any suggestions how to address this issue?
Senator Roblin, Senator Barrett-Sugar, I think the only suggestion I can really give you is we really need to take that into account more up front when we make future land use decisions in terms of non-farm development in farming areas and redesignation of lands that were at one time zoned for farm or forest use. We need to take that into account much better in terms of the analysis before we decide we're going to make those decisions and convert farm or forest land.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you all. As we get bills of kind that have issues, we'll ask you to come back and help us. So thank you. So we'll close that informational hearing, and we'll open an informational meeting on the Oregon State University statewide public service programs. And Dr. Ray, Dan Arp, Scott Reed, and Thomas Manis, if you're all here, we'd love to have you come up and pull up one more chair, I think.
It is an issue.
And thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Chair Will.
I think it has a lot to do with this.
That's why we have road rate.
And I guess while they're getting set up, I just want to say from the perspective of many of us in the rural areas, but I believe more should be understood by the urban areas as well, the resource that's available to us through these statewide programs that are provided from us through Oregon State University are really essential for the development in our areas, especially in the rural areas. That's the ones I know the best, but I've talked to people who understand that it's also true in the urban areas, and I just thought it was a good time to have a real conversation about what we have, the gem that we have, in my opinion, and then the kinds of things that I think we need to do to make it sustainable for in the future. So with that, Dr. Ray, I'll let you
thank
start.
You, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I was going to say thank you for those observations. That concludes my testimony. It's wonderful to be here with you. My colleagues and I look forward to taking a few minutes to give you a sense of the services provided by the OSU statewide programs. The OSU statewides include the Agricultural Experiment Station, the Forest Research Laboratory, and the Extension Service, and they literally reach into every county and community in Oregon. Furthermore, statewide program faculty also hold faculty positions with the university and colleges, including the Colleges of Science, Public Health and Human Sciences, Agricultural Sciences, Forestry, Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. OSU provides more than $2 billion in economic activity annually to the Oregon economy. We documented that in a study in 2012. We also documented that $980 million of that economic footprint resides outside of the central Willamette Valley in the rest of the state. The Agricultural Experiment Station and the Forest Research Laboratory provide research and commercialization support for $45 billion worth of business annually in Oregon. They directly serve the 8 industry clusters identified in the Oregon Business Plan. The statewides generated $80 million in research support last year alone, We believe that accounted for $180 million in economic activity and helped to create more than 2,000 jobs. The statewide support families and communities throughout the state and attract over 14,000 volunteers who provide more than 2 million hours of service, including a 4-H program that serves 1 in 5 K-12 students and their families. Having provided those brief overview observations, I'm happy now to turn to my colleague Dan Arp to comment.
Just before you do that,
yeah.
For the record, you need to identify yourself.
Oh.
I asked you who you were and so you started going. No problem.
Ed Ray, President, Oregon State University. And I'm happy to turn the program over to Dan Arp, the Dean of our College of Agricultural Sciences, to provide more observations on the Agricultural Experiment Station.
Thank you, President Ray. Senator Roblin, committee members, again, my name is Dan Arp. I am Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences and also Director of the Oregon Agricultural Experiment Station. So what I'd like to do is just say a few words about the experiment station, but before that, I want to actually direct your attention to a map that we have, because the three components of the statewide, the Ag Experiment Station, the Extension Service, and the Forest Research Lab, we truly do look at the state of Oregon as our campus. And so what we see up there now are the representations of the different places in which we have physical facilities. So you see the two stars, which represent the two OSU campuses, the Corvallis campus and the Bend campus. We also have forest research experiment stations across the state. Those are represented with the triangles. We have experiment stations. So these are branch stations of the larger experiment station that's in Corvallis, but we also have stations across the state. And we have places where we have both research and extension in one location, and then we also have a number of county extension offices as well. So hopefully this map makes it apparent that we are indeed located across the state. Another point to make in this is that we have been there for a very long time in some of these locations. So there are at least two locations where the branch experiment stations have been there for more than 100 years, and we are an integrated part of that community. So we really are part of that rural community in those areas. If you could click me forward, Scott. Just in terms of what we do in the Agricultural Experiment Station, so we are the research component of our tripartite mission in the college, which is education, research, and extension. So I'm talking now just about the research piece, which is funded through the Agricultural Experiment Station. And what we do there is carry out research and innovation that's in support of our mission, which is around food, agriculture, and natural resource-based economies. So we're going to do the research that is necessary to keep those economies strong. To do that, we have about 110 full-time equivalents in professor positions. So those are spread out over more actual people, but about 110 total FTE. We have about a total of 400 scientists altogether, including the researchers, technicians, professors, and so on. And as President Ray already indicated, they are spread out across the college, most across the university. Most are in the College of Ag Sciences, but we do have FTE located in other colleges as well. So making sure that we're integrated across the food, agriculture, and natural resources spectrum. President Ray also mentioned this, but in the Ag Experiment Station, we take our roughly $25 million a year budget, and we leverage that to bring in another $63 million in grants, contracts, private donations, commission dollars, et cetera. So leverage that. And then those are the dollars that we have available to deal with our mission. About $50 million of that is in federal grants and contracts, by the way. So we deal with environmental, economic, and societal sustainability. So when we look at what we're trying to accomplish, we're certainly concerned about sustaining the environment so that we can continue to use the land productively, but that won't work unless there's an economic benefit and the societies, those rural communities, also have to benefit. We also are about understanding the complex systems that underlie these economies. For example, we need to understand a complex system in this case could be a plant, an animal, a bacterium. It can also be an ecosystem. It can be a farmer's field, or it can be the economy that supports that, that underlies that. So all of those are the complex systems that we work in. State of Oregon is remarkable in the diversity of the commodities that we have in the state, second only to California in terms of the number of commodities. There are over 220 different commodities in the state, and we need to address all of those. Now, what I want to do, I can't talk to you about all 220 right now, but what I'd like to do is just give you a flavor of how this works. And if I could see the next slide, Scott. So sort of lumping together areas of fruits, and those fruits becoming important in production of wines, fermentation, and other areas of fermentation. And then this leads to agritourism. So a number of things that kind of group together under this heading, thinking about the fruits. When we think about fruits very broadly, we're talking about watermelons in Hermiston. We're thinking about cranberries over on the coast. We're thinking about cherries and apples in the Hood River area. Blueberries, strawberries, caneberries in the Willamette Valley. And, of course, grapes across much of Oregon, where it's possible to grow grapes. Grapes are an excellent example of how we can take a farm gate product and add value to it here in the state of Oregon, and then that those wines become an export product for the state as well. So many different ways in which we can use those. Nature throws a lot of challenges, though, at the growers of the fruits in Oregon, and so we're there to help with that. If this is an insect infestation, if this is a disease, it's finding better varieties, drought tolerance, and so on, we're there to help do that. That's part of our job. Fruit's also important, of course, in a healthy diet, and we collaborate with other colleges on campus to help find those components in those fruits that contribute to a healthy diet. Also important in terms of, as I mentioned earlier, agritourism. So this is an opportunity to bring additional dollars into a rural economy by taking advantage of the tourism opportunities that take place. Think about wineries and bringing people in there. Also has the opportunity to create new businesses, and we see that going on a lot in the state of Oregon. Again, wineries being a very good example of that, as we see more and more wineries coming online in the state of Oregon. As we think about fermentation, though, we can also think about other areas where that's important, production of beer, but also cheeses. So fermentation spreads across those different industries, and now we have artisan cheese makers showing up in the state of Oregon and increasing rapidly in numbers. Last thing I'll mention then is the markets that are opened up through these activities. So, of course, we have the local markets where these berries, these fruits can be sold at farmers markets locally. They can also be sold through community supported agriculture, your CSA boxes. But of course, they also open up urban and even international markets. So right now we have, for example, blueberries heading to Korea. So all sorts of different opportunities where we can open up international markets. So I will stop there and turn the floor over to my colleague, Scott Reed.
Thank you, Dan. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Scott Reed. I serve at Oregon State University as Vice Provost for Outreach and Engagement, and I direct the OSU Extension Service. As you may know, the Extension Service is an incredibly diverse institution. Here I'm reminded of the parable of the blind man and the elephant, where you believe you know it based upon what part you touch. For more than 100 years, OSU Extension has placed two-thirds of its workforce in Oregon communities. The other one-third are on campus, where they work collegially in a colleague way with the rest of the OSU faculty. The local faculty, though, provide an essential link between community needs and research-based knowledge. In cooperation with the Ag Experiment Station and the Forest Research Lab, research results are tested and adapted to local conditions. So now, designed educational programs help to implement improved and effective practices for both the established and the emerging workforce. One recent example is we derived a need and began to develop network administrator training for Google when they went into Central Oregon and found that that was an important rural workforce need for them. Extension addresses problems through constant monitoring and stakeholder connections that allows us to respond more quickly than we might without having those local faculty there. And you've heard many examples of insect and disease kind of monitoring and responses. Positive youth development is job one for the 1 in 5 K-12 youth that we touch through the OSU 4-H program. One key emphasis of 4-H is the needed programs in science, technology, engineering, and math. Community-based economic development is supported through educational programs that look to expand and develop new businesses. An example in Tillamook County is what we call a recipe to market program that's actually inspired the development of new businesses in that county in cooperation with the OSU Food Innovation Center. Economic welfare of families is enhanced by extension education that addresses things like nutrition, financial management, health issues, and child obesity. And finally, connecting community-based audiences to local educational resources that include things like community colleges and our growing portfolio of online educational opportunities. In this way, extension faculty help to assist things like degree completion and pathways to educational credentials that we believe plays an important role in the state's 40-40-20 agenda. Now, because so much extension impacts are realized locally, I thought it'd be useful to accomplish, on average, what one full-time equivalent, or FTE, extension faculty member, is normally able to produce. Most counties across the state have 2 to 6 or so extension educators who are resident there. They're responsible typically for a specific area of programming, but they more and more cover multiple counties. As our resources have become limited, we've had to thin the soup and spread people over wider geographies. On average, though, for each full-time equivalent extension faculty member, there are 8,000 direct educational contacts accomplished annually. This doesn't count the media-based and web hits, but these are Oregonians that receive a face-to-face educational lesson through the extension service. An average of 52 volunteers are supported for every full-time equivalent, whether they're trained individuals such as master gardeners or whether they're volunteer leaders of our 4-H clubs and helping us with youth leadership. More than 4,000 K-12 youth are served in traditional 4-H, after-school, or school enrichment programs by one full-time equivalent 4-H faculty member. Many of those youth members are served through trained youth or volunteer leaders, however. Nearly $100,000 of grant and contract resources are earned through local partnerships and competitive sources by virtue of having the capacity through extension faculty who see the needs and then develop partnerships and resources to address specific needs. This expansion of our abilities is only possible with the base capacity provided by state funds. And I'll stop there and we'll pass to the Forest Research Lab.
Thank you, Scott. Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Thomas Manis, and I am the new dean of the College of Forestry. I started in August of last year, and this is my inaugural visit here before a committee. I want to tell you a little bit about the College of Forestry. We have about 1,000 students in our program and about 65 faculty and extension agents around the state, and we like to call ourselves a College of Healthy Landscapes. We're working really hard right now to rebrand our college to be about healthy landscapes. And when we think of a healthy landscape, it requires healthy ecosystems, healthy people, healthy communities, and healthy businesses. And I think if you look around Oregon right now, we have a lot of work to do in the College of Forestry to really promote that connection between ecosystems and communities and healthy people. And that's a challenge that we're really keen to take on. If you look at the forest industry in Oregon relative to the rest of the world, Oregon is the number one forest economy in the United States. At $12 billion, it leads the nation in forest products. And not just that, it's the best place in the world from an environmental standpoint to grow trees. If you think about other places in the world where you grow timber quickly, there are non-native species in areas of the world where water is a challenge, and that's not an issue here. We have native species, abundant water, and minimal addition of chemicals and fertilizers necessary to grow trees. So from an environmental standpoint, this is the place, and Lane County is the best place in the world to grow timber from a value point of view, because it's also a very high-valued species that we grow here as compared to very low-valued species that are grown in the rest of the world. And so I think that gives us a real competitive advantage to the rest of the world. If I can tell you a little bit about our college, we work in four principal areas. The first is working forests, and you see working forests all up and down the western part of our state, but also the production of high quality and high value wood products. And that connection there ties right in with the idea of building with wood and living with wood that we really wish to repurpose the state of Oregon and the people that live in Oregon about the importance and the health factors of living and building with wood. but also we're involved in the stewardship of natural ecosystems that relate to an $8 billion tourist industry in the state of Oregon. So combined with forest products and tourism, we're talking about a $20 billion industry that largely depends upon forest. And stewarding this the natural ecosystems that make up our state is, as you know, very complex undertaking. And finally, and I think most importantly, we're becoming much more involved in the social aspect of forestry and really understanding communities and understanding people and their relation to ecosystems and how that can translate into good jobs and sustainable economies. I just want to tell you just a little bit about the funding of our college. And I'll use last year as an example. We received about $2.7 million in statewide public funding support for research in our college. The industry makes a direct match of that, and they matched it with $3.5 million of their own money through the Harvest Tax Fund. So more than a one-to-one match. That was again matched by $15 million of grants and contracts attracted to the College of Forestry. So $2.7 million of state funding generates $20 million of funding for our college. Without that $20 million, we wouldn't have a college. We'd have, just like all the other states in the United States, very small and insignificant colleges of forestry. But Oregon State University College of Forestry is the largest and most comprehensive college of forestry in the nation. And we generate about 100 graduates a year that go directly into our workforce. And it's because of that matching that we're able to do that. So every dollar that we're given through our statewide public service translates to $7 of direct, we can show evidence of matching funding of that. So our college, which is a $25 million enterprise in total from our state funding, from statewide public service and ENG funding, that's only, the state support is only 20% of our entire college, which is a remarkably efficient program for as big as we are. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And are there some questions first? I have a couple things. First, I want to say a personal thank. As I learned my new district, I found out the work that was done by Oregon State with regard to saving the shellfish industry in Oregon, and actually on the West Coast. I don't know how many people know how closely we're to losing all production of oysters and others in Washington and Oregon because of the changing oceans, and you couldn't get the seed to start making a shell, and without having Oregon State start working with our private industry to do the testing of the water and then figuring out what it was that needed to be added to the water to have that industry resumed. We have the largest producer for private stocks of oysters on the West Coast in Neatarts Bay, all there, and they would be the first to tell us. If it hadn't been for OSU, that would not have happened. And, you know, they are introducing the local oysters. They are working on production of a whole bunch of other seafoods, and could not happen if it hadn't been for the work done by your university. So I want to personally thank you from a perspective of my local area. And I think that people who don't know some of those things don't understand how valuable it is to have the resource and the number it takes, like you were saying with this, with forestry. You have to have a mass. You have to have a base of enough people to have the interactions that are necessary to find that next thing, to solve the next problem with the next worm that comes in into our fruit crops that we had here a few years ago. All of those things happen because there are people already ready and there. And I guess I looked at the governor's budget, and they have flat-funded these programs. I shouldn't say again, because I think we underfunded the last time. So my understanding is, you know, flat funding is not going to let you continue doing what you're doing, I would not expect, because there are inflationary costs. So I'm very concerned about that personally, and I'd just like to know if you have any comments.
Well, thank you, Chair Roblin. We're concerned about that as well, and you're right. Flat funding will not allow us to continue to operate all of our programs at their current level. What we're asking for, we understand that we're still living in difficult times, but what we're asking for is the same proposed increase in funding for the statewide public services that's been recommended for all of higher education. As I said at the outset, outset, these programs are an integral part of who we are and what we do, and they provide extraordinary dividends for the people of Oregon. So we're actually asking for an additional $7 million for the statewide public services. That would represent roughly to 3 to 3.5% per year during the biennium that has already been proposed for higher education.
Other questions? Yes.
I can't resist. What did you put in the water?
You.
How did we save the mullets? I'm a seafood enthusiast.
The water. So this happened before. I've been in the deanship for about 9 months now. But if I recall correctly, it was really a matter of pH. So correcting the pH.
The acidity of it.
Yeah.
They brought equipment. They brought research students and all that kind of stuff to this particular site. And they monitor the water every day, and then they add what it takes to make it exactly what they need for the larva to produce. And then they can be sent all over the world in little packages. It's a pretty remarkable thing.
That is remarkable.
And you should come by, because they also, we don't do it in Oregon, but in Washington, gooey ducks, they produce the seed for gooey ducks, which are natural to Oregon, and we should be doing. But I'll talk to my agriculture people.
Yeah, I agree, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And they have actually shown that commercialized gooey ducks in Washington have restored wetlands and made things better, so I think there's reasons to do that.
Our colleagues actually have been demonstrating over a number of years that ocean acidification is becoming a more and more severe problem, not just for oysters, but for many species, and needs to be monitored and dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Presence.
Thank you. Dan, this is more for you on the slide where you had the wineries. I know that Senator Burdick was very pleased to see that. I was somewhat surprised you didn't put craft brewing up there since you have the best fermentation center. And also, I would assume that you're also maybe assisting them. One other growth area is distilleries that are coming online. And I think that you're going to see another boom in economics, relying on a lot of ag product to make a added value product.
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Roblin, yeah, thank you for that comment. Absolutely. I don't have enough time, as I said, to talk about all the different things that are going on, but certainly the craft brewing is one of the spectacular success stories going on, and it's also one of the success stories in terms of vertically integrating. So we work all the way from the hops and the barley, in some cases the wheat, to the water. All pieces need to come together and then bring the fermentation into it. And then thinking about the fermentation there, that influences and informs fermentation in other fermentation-driven industries like wine and cheese and bread. So it's very delightful to have the entire integrated system that we can work with and having that base. You mentioned distilleries. That's an area that we are just now getting into. We're actually working through the regulatory requirements to be able to do that on campus, but we have a beautiful copper still that was donated by Ed King, and we're anxious to get it running.
No, Ed will. Yeah, the other thing, if I could, is that the just in the craft brewing, and just seeing, as you're saying, how we can actually, within the state of Oregon, have all of the items, products that we need individually. The malting is, I think, one of the newest areas I'm seeing in North Willamette Valley, if I'm not mistaken, outside of McMinnville, there's a family that's supposedly building a malting operation.
Thank you. And
you bet. Yeah.
I guess I'll say my last comment, because I like to hit all of you. My wife's an elementary principal, and one of the things that she has seen the need for is making sure that some of her population, we have a very poor population in Coos Bay, understands how they could make a much better use of the food sources they have, and especially if they can and preserve foods in ways that their grandparents did, and they don't have the skills. And the extension agents have come to the school, and they've done things in the schools and trainings in the evenings with parents about how to go about producing and using products that they really didn't know how to use. And again, I don't want us to lose the skills that generations had before that we don't seem to have had for a while. So I thank you for that one as well. So
thank you.
I guess with that, we'll say thank you all for being here.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you for the time.
And so we'll close our informational hearing. And I guess I'm committed to making sure that we continue to keep these programs viable. So I'll talk to other people
Absolutely.
As we go. The next one is we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 194. And we'll hear a short statement about, and while we're doing that,
We have Lauren Henderson and Jim Kramer to come up from ODA, and they can come up while we're talking.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 194 repeals provisions regulating produce dealers in ORS Chapter 585. It repeals requirement that wholesale produce dealer, retail produce peddler, or cash buyer obtain license from Oregon Department of Agriculture. And it removes requirements that wholesale produce dealers obtain surety bonds or letters of credit.
Once again, Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I have with me Jim Kramer, who is one of our program directors for our marketing and inspection program area, and this program falls under that. Just as a way of a little background, hopefully we're bringing to you two bills today, this one being the first, Senate Bill 194, that is a result of our agency doing some house cleaning. A couple years ago, we started looking at our rules and statutes and looking for those that really time had passed by and had become obsolete. This bill, Senate Bill 194, repeals what has become an outdated statute, which requires a license or a license and bond for dealers, buyers, and peddlers of produce. The purpose of the statute in its day, and when I say in its day, we're talking probably the 50s, 60s. I always think of Green Acres a little bit and the guy with his little peddler truck going around. But really the purpose of the statute was to ensure that producers got paid for their products when they gave it to someone to distribute. Today, the amount of bonding that is required, which is $15,000, wouldn't even begin to pay for part of a load, let alone of a load. And so we're collecting a license fee. It's fairly small. We're not doing anything with that. We don't have an active inspection program because, frankly, there isn't a need for it. We have not had a complaint in this program, I believe, in over 10 years. And after talking with folks in the industry, it was really clear that this just really could be repealed. We give back a few folks a little bit of license dollars that aren't needed anymore. And so with that, I'd be glad to go through the bill line by line if you'd like, but
I don't think there's any need. Is there? Well, thank you very much. Is there anybody else here who would like to testify on Senate Bill 194? Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 194. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 194. Do I have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate Bill 194 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Bearsugar moves Senate Bill 194 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Close.
I have to say I'm just thrilled to see the words repeals, repeals, removes, revokes. I haven't seen that in a long time. So I think this is a good housekeeping measure.
Any other discussion? Seeing none. Anybody opposed to this bill? Seeing no opposition, it passes. And we will close our hearing on
carrier.
Pardon?
You need a carrier.
Oh, we do need a carrier.
Senator Bearson.
Or Close. Would you like to carry a bill that?
I'd be happy to.
Yeah. A little more excitement on the floor.
An exciting one.
We have another
one. You're next.
Yeah, that's right. So we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 195. And we'll have a short explanation. And while that's happening, Lauren and Roger Beyer are certainly invited up to the.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 195 repeals ORS Chapter 583 regarding milk marketing, production, and distribution. It repeals the requirement that Oregon Department of Agriculture audit fluid milk handler records pertaining to pooling and usage of milk and payments to producers.
And with that, I'll invite you back.
Once again, Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, continuing with the theme of repealing. Senate Bill 195 does just that. It would abolish ORS Chapter 583 in its entirety. The program for which 583 authorized more commonly was known as the Milk Stabilization Act. It was a program that was established really to help, and I'm barely remember some of this, and the folks that used to be at our agency are no longer there. But the whole purpose of the program was to stabilize supply of milk, frankly, and ensure that milk producers were able to have a share of the market. I don't know, in the 20s, I think our history tells us that milk used to be very volatile at certain points in time, and you can go back in history and find lots of newspaper articles about milk shortages and the like. So that's what this program did. We had several staff. Like all things, there was a federal market order that came about, and slowly our state moved to that federal milk order, and in 1987 there was the recommendation not only from our agency but from the milk industry in Oregon itself to do away with the program and abolish it in 1987. It's been on the books since then. I think there was some thought to kind of keep it in everyone's back pocket just in case we needed to go back to something, in case something happened at the federal level. But even if that were to be contemplated today, time has certainly passed it by, and it is not workable in the format that it is, and we would all be back in front of you, Roger and I, and et al., with something that was probably totally different. So with that, I'll end with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and I really have nothing to add to what Mr. Henderson said. I think my message would be that if Oregon did want to start regulating milk markets again, the statute would all have to be rewritten anyway, so might as well get rid of this one and move forward into the next century.
Okay. Any questions?
Maybe just got into this one.
Any questions? Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 195, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 195.
Mr. Chair, as a person that had spent a few hours in the milk parlors over the years, I would like to move 195 to go to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And I mean, both these, I didn't mention it before, it's on our list, that neither one has a fiscal or a revenue impact, so we're good for that one, or fiscal impact. So Senator Bertschinger moves Senate Bill 195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Also seeing none. So passes, and since you have had some time being in a milking parlor, we'll let you
carry
the bill.
I'd be happy to.
Very good. So we are now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 348. And with that, we've got Scott, is it Reed, and Roger Beyer again. Oh, and Sean, thank you. I don't see the other person. Ross.
I think Scott signed up in the wrong place.
Okay, no, that makes sense. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm still Roger Beyer, representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. In front of you is Senate Bill 348, brought to you at my request, or the request of the dairy farmers. This bill, and I want to point out, too, that this bill is co-sponsored by Senators Girard and Johnson. And that is something that no one thought would probably ever be possible again in this assembly, that those two chief co-sponsor a bill together. With that, what this bill, and my written testimony is in front of you. I'm not going to read it. I'm not going to go through it line by line. You can all read and have the ability to do that on your own. I'll just hit the highlights. What this bill simply does is allows a commodity commission to adopt a fiscal year that is other than the state fiscal year. Under current law, the state fiscal year, which is from January 1st to June 30th, and all the commodity commissions in the state are required to use that as their fiscal year also. And this bill allows them the option to adopt a calendar year instead. The reason this is being brought forward is specifically for the dairy industry. The Dairy Commission, which is part of and works very closely with the federal dairy marketing program, I'm not sure exactly what it's in here, the exact name of it, but they work on a calendar year, and it's becoming more and more difficult for the Oregon Dairy Commission to interact with the Federal Commission on a calendar year versus a fiscal year. So this bill simply allows commissions, if they choose to do so, to adopt a calendar year. We do know that the Dairy Commission is interested in doing that. I have not heard of any other commissions at this point in time. I believe there are 27 commodity commissions in the state. This would not affect the Wheat Commission, but all the rest of the commissions are in this chapter of law, Chapter 576, I think is which one it is. Yes, Chapter 576. So if they choose to, they can adopt. They will have to run one short fiscal year to get to a calendar year basis, and then they'll be operating on a calendar year. It's pretty simple. It's an option. It doesn't mandate anything to anybody. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions on my testimony or the written testimony you have in front of you.
So any questions?
I think just to set the record straight, Roger, I think you said January 1 instead of July 1 for the start of the fiscal year for the state.
Excuse me, that's if I said January 1, I meant July 1.
Right.
Currently, yes.
And then I did want to follow up, and I just, so the USDA, theirs is on a calendar year. It's not on the federal fiscal year, which would be October 1 to September 30th?
That is correct. They work on a calendar year at the federal USDA for the milk marketing program.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions of this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much, Roger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 348, and we'll open a work session. Do we have all the stuff for this one?
Mr. Chair, there's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
So we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 348, and I'll entertain a motion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 348 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bertschinger moves Senate Bill 348 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I appreciate that they made this a voluntary choice as opposed to the other, so that the other commissions can decide what they want to do and where they want to be. So I appreciate that part of the bill. So is there any objection to this bill being passed? Seeing none, it passes, and Senator Pozanski will carry this one on the floor. And with that, I will correct on 194. There was a minimal impact,
fiscal
impact. So, but it was minimal. So, and I had said earlier that I thought they were both none. So, just to correct that for the record. With that, is there any other things that people would like to talk about with today's? Because we have finished our business of the committee. Any questions, thoughts, or concerns? Anybody in the audience that would like to say something or not, we'll give you an opportunity. You got a moment. With that, we're going to adjourn the first meeting of the Senate Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee. Thank you all for being here.